You are listening to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Now, before we take a walk into the interview room, where we're going to have our very interesting guest, as we always do, let's take a walk into the briefing room, where I'm going to give you my view from the blue. This week saw tragedy on an almost unimaginable scale in America, with the dual mass shootings, one taking place at the Walmart in El Paso, Texas, and the other at a popular night spot in Dayton, Ohio. Let's talk about the Walmart incident first. An individual, I'm not going to talk about his name because we're not going to give him that respect. This punk goes into the Walmart. Well, first he drives into the parking lot, and he is armed with a long gun, a semi-automatic rifle, which he apparently purchased legally, opened fire in the parking lot, and killed a number of people there. According to witnesses, he then walked into the Walmart and methodically, for almost 20 minutes, inflicted this horrendous carnage, killing children, killing babies, killing mothers, targeting apparently people of Mexican descent. The toll was horrendous. 22 dead, more on the verge of dying themselves because of their medical condition. He shot many, many more. The question, of course, is why? Well, it seems that this sick animal was angry, and he left what is being referred to as a manifesto on some deranged website that caters to white supremacists. And in it, he railed about illegal immigration and Mexicans taking over America, and he was going to do something about it. So he gathered his ammunition, got his rifle, put on eye protection and ear protection, and then, in a cowardly attack, indiscriminately shot and killed all those people, shot many, many more. He didn't have any significant criminal history. There was apparently no warnings that he was going to do this. He's just another sick, deranged individual who was considered a loner, weird, but nobody saw this coming. Now, the investigation is still in its infancy. The El Paso police have a tremendous amount of work to do. But the reality is this: yet another mass shooting in America. And we're no closer to figuring out why than we were years and years ago. What is it that sets these people off into these killing sprees? You know, this guy had an ideology, a sick white supremacist ideology, a hatred for an entire people. Why? This is something that investigators will try and locate. And then what's surprising about this incident, though, is he wasn't killed by the police and he didn't take his own life, which is not the norm. And so the investigators will actually have a live person to interrogate. And very similar to the Parkman shooting in Florida, After he was done with his shooting spree, he left the Walmart and was stopped by police and quickly surrendered. So this is going to be chalked up to, once again, a madman with a gun, a rifle. Of course, it's being called an assault rifle. It is not, but that's what the media is calling it. And the politicians have already started using this platform, this tragedy, to feather their own political nests and to score political points. They are putting the blame on the President of the United States. It's just another example of the corruption and the self-aggrandizement of politicians and their complicit media. 12 hours, just 12 hours after this horrible shooting, it happened again. This time, thousands of miles away, Dayton, Ohio. Another individual, no significant criminal history. Although there were warning signs of hate and of mental illness and threats years prior, another individual, early 20s, went with his sister and her sister's friend to a very popular night spot area of Dayton, Ohio. There's a number of bars and restaurants there. And once they got there, apparently they separated. And this punk left his sister and her friend in either this particular bar or another bar, then left, put on body armor, and armed himself with a rifle, went back and opened fire on the innocent people in the bar. You know, he did so from outside. There's some surveillance video that shows what took place, but from outside, he opened fire on the outside seating area of the bar and inside, and killed 9 people. Shot many more. One of those that he killed was his sister. Whether that was intentional or she just happened to be where he was shooting is yet to be determined. Now, the law enforcement response was swift and deadly because the Dayton police officers who responded did so within a minute. Luckily, there was a strong police presence there. And also, luckily, some of these officers were armed with patrol rifles because this individual had on ballistic armor. The officers, 6 of them, opened fire within 30 seconds of the attack beginning. And you can see in the surveillance video that the gunman was trying to get into the bar. And had he succeeded with the high-powered rifle that he had and the extra magazines, he could have wreaked absolute devastation. It was bad enough he killed 9 and wounded many, many more, but it could have, the death toll could have been just mind-boggling. If not for the professional response by law enforcement, they killed him within 30 seconds. You know, once again, we have another mass shooting that takes place in an American city. And once again, we have no idea why. This individual had in previous times, while in high school, he was suspended for writing out a list of people he wanted to kill and women he wanted to rape, and he told people about it. And they threw him out of school, which is exactly what they should have done. But when questioned, people who knew him were not surprised that he had snapped, that he had done exactly what he did, that he killed. This is going to take a lot of soul-searching and investigation. What do you do when someone, puts out into the public or into private conversations these decidedly threatening thoughts? You know, the criminal justice system isn't set up to be the thought police. It's based on action. But once again, when we see individuals who espouse a certain threatening demeanor or reveal a violent nature, are we as a country impotent to do anything about it? I think that there has to be some real thought put into this now. You know, there are red flag laws that are now really just coming to the fore. A red flag law being a law that says, this person is either mentally ill or threatening in some way, and so he shouldn't possess a weapon. And there are two schools of thought here. One is just go take the gun away and then let him go to court and get it back, or which is in my belief unconstitutional, but is yet being done in certain states. And then there is another avenue where there actually is some court proceeding, and in that court proceeding, a judge issues a ruling that says, I think that there is enough cause here for law enforcement to remove the weapon from his possession. So I think that at this point, we as a nation have to actually start looking at preventative measures. Now, this is difficult ground to forge across, because when does an individual lose their rights to possess a firearm? You know, this is a country that loves its guns. There's millions and millions. There's more guns than there is people. And so when I hear people in political circles or the media talking about banning guns, I just have to shake my head, because it's never going to happen. It can't physically happen. It's an impossibility. There are gun laws, however, that do exist, and maybe it's time to really start re-examining these. So, okay, let's talk about another related topic. We have a mass shooting in Texas. We have a mass shooting in Dayton, both with multiple fatalities and injuries. But the same weekend, in the city of Chicago, 7 people are killed and 46 more are shot the same weekend. And yet, that was buried on page 49. We have a city in America that has more than 60 shootings. Are you kidding me? And here's the irony. Illinois has some of the toughest gun laws in the country. They're not working. Why aren't they working? Well, let's examine what's taking place there. These shootings are predominantly involving gang members, gang activities, and narcotics activities. So these are true criminals that are shooting, in some cases, other criminals. In others, people just, innocents caught in the crossfire. They don't care. But the Chicago police, when they arrest people, gangbangers with guns, the judges don't keep them in jail. They let them go. There was a weekend just a couple weeks ago where the Chicago Police Department put forth an effort to rid a certain neighborhood of guns. And they made arrests, and they took lots of guns off the street. And the arrests that they made, the judges released all of the individuals, every single person that got caught with a gun. So what good is having strong laws on the books regarding guns and gun violence, and then they're ignored by the judges? You see, I'm a believer in mass incarceration. I know that is about the most politically incorrect statement anybody could make these days, but it's true. If you put people in jail who are violent criminals, and you know that they are, and they get caught with a gun, they get caught doing a criminal activity with a gun, why in God's name do we not put them away? Because of politics. Because of new political correctness. We don't even make them post bond anymore in many occasions. They just release them. All in the name of social justice. Well, it's time to start doing something about it. The criminal activities, in one sense, is a much easier answer than the mass shootings by these madmen. And I can't help but think that these young men, because it's predominantly just that, young white men of backgrounds that are not from poverty. They're generally middle class. And yet, something deranges them. I don't know whether it's violent video games, whether it's social media, which has perverted their minds, but something has got to give. And just espousing the usual rhetoric of gun control isn't going to do it. Well, that's about it for me today before we take a walk into the interview room. That, my friends, is my view from the blue. I want to tell you guys about a pretty amazing product. It's called Arrest My Vest Spray. And really what it's designed to do is when you are wearing a ballistic vest, you know, it gets sweaty, it gets hot, it gets drenched, from working out in the street. And sometimes it doesn't smell all that well. And this is an amazing product that takes that odor away. And you don't even have to use it just for the vest. It takes pet odors away. It's great for your vest. It's great for your dog bed. Everything else that you need a deodorizer for, this stuff is amazing. Check it out. It's at stinkyvest.com. Go to stinkyvest.com and check out Arrest My Vest Spray and arrest the odors. I want to tell you about a company called Law Enforcement Specialists. If you are an active duty law enforcement officer and you're looking to work extra jobs like security and traffic jobs, these are the people you need to go through. We all know that working extra jobs is what gives us the extras. Gives us that little extra payment that we need, or perhaps gives us the opportunity to take our families out to dinner a little more often. And the only way to do it is to be working extra jobs. So what they do is they're all over America. I think they're in everything but a couple of states. And they work with your organization, your administration, and find off-duty jobs to work. You got to check them out. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com and register with them, contact them. Now, if you have security needs, this is the company you want to go through as well. If you are looking for both security or traffic jobs, if you have a company that requires that, you want to contact these folks as well. They're good people. They're based in Arizona, but they have police officers and services all over the country. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com. There's something very important I want you to do for me. If you've been listening to the Voice of American Law Enforcement for any time, you know that we are very dedicated to the law enforcement community here. I would like you to go to a website. It's www.thewoundedblue.org. I want you to read about how we at this organization are aiding injured and disabled law enforcement officers. If you are a law enforcement officer and you have been injured or disabled and you feel forgotten and alone, this is why we exist. We have a fully trained peer support team, all made of police officers who have been shot, stabbed, beaten, run over, screwed up, and screwed over. They know what you're going through, and we exist for you. You are the part of the Blue family, and you deserve to be treated with respect and dignity. Unfortunately, many police agencies and cities do not treat their officers with respect and dignity when they are injured, either physically or emotionally. So go to thewoundedblue.org. If you are a citizen and you want to help, please check out how you can join the Wounded Blue. And if you're a police officer or have been, exist for you. So check out thewoundedblue.org. Now, I would also urge you to see our film. It is on Amazon, it is on iTunes, it's the Microsoft Store, it's pretty much every platform you can imagine. It's called The Wounded Blue, Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. You would be shocked at how the men and women of this, you know, the law enforcement community in this country, many are being treated with such disrespect. Many people, most people, even cops, believe that if you are severely injured in the line of duty, you're going to be taken care of financially and emotionally. In many cases, that is not true. Please watch the film and help the Wounded Blue.
It's your news and entertainment network. News blogs, informative podcasts, entertaining videos, or listen to 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We the People, AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio. The question I always get asked is, where do I get the energy from? Well, keeping up with Malcolm Out Loud is no easy task, friends, even for Malcolm. Well, you may know that I've personally been taking Healthy Cell for some time now. Well, the great news is Healthy Cell has a new type of natural supplement called the Nutrition Gel. So no more hard-to-swallow pills. The good-tasting gel can be mixed into smoothies, yogurt, or water. These gels provide maximum absorption of essential nutrients, and it's healthy for our gut, not abrasive like pills can be. You know, it's time for all of us to go pill-free. And you can try it with a free 2-day supply. Just cover $2.95 shipping, and the company Healthy Cell will cover the cost of the product. Go to healthycell.com/outloud, or simply click the Healthy Cell logo at the top of AmericaOutloud.com.
With me today in the interview room of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is my friend Pat Yose, who is the National Secretary for the Fraternal Order of Police, which is the largest police union in the United States. He is also an active duty law enforcement officer with the St. Charles Parish Sheriff's Office, has held a position in law enforcement for decades, and has been a staunch supporter and member of the Fraternal Order of Police for decades as well. Pat, thanks so much for being on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Randy, thanks for having me. It's some strange times we find ourselves in law enforcement today, and we'll try and sort through some of the issues that are facing us today.
You know, there is one thing that is never a shortage of, and that is topics about the American law enforcement officer and things that are going along along with the all the social changes, the challenges that are facing American law enforcement today. And so let's get into some of these things right now. First of all, tell us a little bit about your law enforcement career.
Well, I started in 1984, 35 years with St. Charles Parish Sheriff's Office, just right outside the city of New Orleans, part of the New Orleans metro area, and I've worked myself through the ranks of my agency. It's a sheriff's office with no municipality, so we're the sole law enforcement agency. And I've worked for pretty much every position within the agency over the 35 years. My last 14, 15 years has been in as a commander of the Special Services Division. It's the outreach programs, public information, public relation, and victims assistance, some of the elderly programs, youth programs, things trying to change the attitudes of the public in the way they perceive us, but at the same time also recognizing that some of the things that we do really are preventive at a very early age if we're going to have any profound impact on trying to curb some of the trends that exist in this country. So these programs are geared towards doing just that.
Well, I'd say you've got your work cut out for you in that regard, considering the narrative that has been in the sights of social media and the mainstream media now for years has been basically a narrative of lies about the law enforcement community. And so trying to change that, that's a major challenge.
No doubt. If you think about it, we're a nation that's losing our moral compass, and technology is helping us push it along at lightning speed. We've become a society teeming with hostile attitudes towards anything having to do with authority, and they arm themselves with half facts and, in a lot of cases, outright fabrications. Social media is building support for this misguided belief. And it's not helped in Hollywood. They glorify murder. It's constantly, it's a fantasy world, and social media is allowing it to happen. And what's really happening is people who have these adverse opinions about things and their hatred, what they're doing is finding people who have similar thought process, and they find validation in it. So there's a lot of factors that are facing us in law enforcement today. And it's very, very little of it has to do with law enforcement itself. It has to do with a deterioration of society where there's no consequences, or consequences are being diminished for actions. And, perhaps what we really need to do is recognize that we need to reach out to people at a younger age and start building those social skills and things that don't have them acting out. The bottom line is, at the end of the day, when kids feel isolated and feel neglected and they're seriously lacking those social skills, their process for socialization and how they develop is compromised. And in doing so, they tend not to have problem thinking skills and the fundamentals for that, and conflict resolution and empathy and all of the other things that have to do with establishing relationships.
You hit it right on the head. I really want to go into this a little bit, because considering the two events that have just rocked this country in the last few days, the mass murders in both El Paso and also in Dayton, Ohio, has dramatically touched this country. And the question is always why? And everybody, every pundit, every politician, everybody that gets their face or on TV or on the radio has a theory. And generally speaking, the theories all revolve around guns instead of the problem itself. And I think what you just said is what is responsible for these horrendous acts. Because if a young man, because generally speaking, it is young men are disaffected and don't have established relationships, then this drives them to that loneliness and that hopelessness and perverts their thinking.
No doubt. If I could, let me just say that our prayers go out to the families of the victims. They desperately want to find something to understand, and the factors are many, and they're extremely complex. And the reality is there is there really is no answer that's going to find any comfort in. But I will tell you one thing that we can all take away. We can definitely take away in each one of these incidents, as horrific as it is. There is one stark image that should be in everyone's mind, and that is that there are police officers who rushed into those incidents, each one of them, to the sounds of gunfire and put their own lives at risk in doing so. There's no question in Dayton and in El Paso, there's no question that they've saved lives at the risk of their own. And that truly is something that we need to embrace and recognize. You see a police officer, you need to thank them, because they have a very difficult job that takes a toll on their lives. And we can have a whole nother segment on the stresses of being a law enforcement officer and what it places on a person who's in this job. But the reality is there are a whole lot of people today that are alive and can be thankful because of the quick action and selfless action of police officers, who it's not in their DNA to let bad things happen to good people. To answer your question, I think we can blame guns for the violent trend that's going on across this country, but it would be ill-conceived. And I preface it by this. You know, we can have this debate about weapons if we'd like, or guns, but the reality is that the true causes is a perfect storm of things that have been brewing for years. It's mental illness, clearly. But some studies show that even if we cured we got a handle on mental illness, we'd only have about a 4% decrease in gun action or gun crimes. I think the bigger thing here is that we're losing those socialization skills. We're losing a whole society because, one, we're not teaching them what they need to do to be problem solvers. Two, we are constantly attacking law enforcement and anything with authority. In reality, what they're doing is they're unraveling the very fabric of America one peace officer at a time and making a very difficult job even worse. So you add all of these things together, law enforcement officers aren't responsible for poverty. They're not responsible for failing school systems, and they're not responsible for broken family units. All of these are key factors of what is causing the hopelessness that exists in people acting out. It's a very big factor, but we're not talking about those. We would rather blame a gun or something else. We have to blame somebody. But there's a much bigger picture here. And until we look at a holistic approach of all of this, we're not going to be effective on blaming any one thing. It's a very complicated mixture that has been a perfect storm brewing for quite some time.
You're absolutely right. Now, here's something I want to explore with you. You're the national secretary of the largest police union in the country, the Fraternal Order of Police. And you've been very active in this organization. When it comes down to the purpose of an organization like the Fraternal Order of Police, how do you see it in the protection of America's law enforcement officers?
Well, I think there are a number of factors, but let's talk about one. One of them has to be the fact that we need to, and it's not just us, there needs to be an assertive effort to change the narrative. The narrative is to quickly blame law enforcement, those authority figures, for the decisions that we make. The bottom line is there's officers all across this country, probably a little under 800,000 across this country, that show up to work every single day and stand a fine line between order and chaos in our communities. And our job is to keep bad people out of the lives of the people we serve. Most would like to think that these people don't exist, but the reality is they do. They absolutely do, and our job is to deal with it. So it's a dirty job. Most of the time, it's mundane, and at times we're called upon to do some pretty extraordinary things. And so I think as an organization and as a society, every organization, you know, everyone is invested in this. We need to recognize that there are consequences for actions. We're not perfect. At times we stumble, but in a bigger picture, we have officers all across this country that are doing an awesome job, and they have the support of the public. And we need to change the narrative and recognize just how important those people who put on a vest and a gun and a badge every day and go out into their communities to protect people and keep bad people out of their lives, just how important they are to the society we live in and the things that we enjoy here in this great country. It is such a cornerstone of what we do. If we don't feel safe in what we do in our homes, in our communities, or anything, then really nothing else matters. So we are the cornerstone of what it takes in order to be able to have a thriving economy, a thriving neighborhood, a thriving schools. All of these things are directly related to how people feel within their communities. And you know what? We're not going to fix that problem by ourselves. We need the public to help us. So we need to stop this narrative. And as an organization, and any organization for that matter, what we need to do is we need to pull together and recognize just how important the law enforcement role is in a free society. And we need to give the credit and the support that's needed in order to be able to do that effective job. It's a partnership. We can't do it alone, but we certainly can't do it when we're constantly taking shots from the very people who are supposed to be supporting us, and public officials and others who are quick to, because of political expediency, to blame us without knowing all the facts or giving half-truths.
You know, I think that's one of the most demoralizing things that we've seen as a profession. The watershed moment that I think has affected law enforcement is the events of the Ferguson debacle. You know, where the greatest lie that's ever been perpetuated by the media was foisted upon the public, the lie of hands up, don't shoot. And we are still seeing it today. There was an article that just came out today, as a matter of fact. There is a I don't know if you're aware of this, but there has been an officer-involved shooting in Colorado Springs where an individual committed an armed robbery. The Colorado Springs officers spotted the suspect. As they were trying to take him into custody, he withdrew a gun from his waistband, and the police shot and killed him. And despite the clear evidence that this guy was armed and was going for his gun, just like Ferguson, quote, witnesses, unquote, came out and said that the police executed him. Now, we know that this isn't true, but right now there is protests going on and people are screaming, hands up, don't shoot, even though that never, ever happened. And this is what cops are facing all over the country. How do you combat that type of lie?
Randy, so what you just identified with Colorado Springs, that's a travesty. But let me tell you, it's not just Colorado Springs. Nashville is going through the same exact thing right now, where an officer had to take action as well with a person who clearly was armed and is being charged for doing basically what he was trained to do, and decided to go home to his family at the end of the shift. So this is something that's happened across the country, and that's a narrative that we absolutely need to change. We're not going to change it alone, but we need to recognize that there are facts. Well, you know, look, our judicial system may not be perfect. There are times when it struggles to find its way, but at the end of the day, it always seems to find its way because we're based on a best rule of evidence, and we let the facts speak for themselves. And when people are quick to make assumptions and to make those judgments based on their own prejudices, well, I would argue with you that when you're making those decisions on your own prejudice, well, isn't that really the definition of social injustice? I mean, there needs to be some science to what we're doing. We need to let facts speak for themselves, and we need to recognize as a process in order to be able to do that. And we're missing the boat with that. Our system is far better than anything else out there. And when we let it take its course, it has a way of getting it right.
You know, you probably are more attuned to this issue than most because of the events that occurred in your neighboring communities where your officers were targeted by a killer and in the name of social justice took the lives and severely injured a number of officers in your neighboring areas. So I would imagine that you're feeling this much more pointedly than many.
There's no doubt. I mean, we are referring to an incident in Baton Rouge where an incident basically grew legs from the media who pushed out a narrative that was not exactly accurate and created an outcry across the country. There's two parts here, okay? Let's talk about the shooting itself. You have officers who are responding to a person walking with a gun who are ambushed, and three of them were killed. And I'm going to tell you, one of them's life will never, ever be the same. And it was clearly geared for hatred. But that hatred grew out of a false narrative. A false narrative that was fed by the media, and it was also fed by public officials who were quick to jump on the bandwagon of stand on a soapbox and talk about social injustice, and they were targeted. Days later, it created the same thing that happened in Dallas. So the hatred goes all the way around. There is consequences. You know, I often use the phrase. The media and public officials are quick to point and blame and point and throw and blame. But yet they're the first ones to say, how did this happen? And you don't get an opportunity to throw fuel on a fire and then curse the very flames that you created. And that's exactly what's happening. We are empowering the hatred by our own speech. We're not letting facts speak for themselves. And as a result, that's what we're dealing with in today's society. Add all of these factors to it. Add the lack of socialization of people at a younger age. Add to the fact that an average kid, some studies show that an average young male, by the time of 18, if he plays video games, has probably executed over 100,000 people in a virtual world by just doing a mechanical reaction by a click, and each one of them is desensitizing them to what reality is. You add all of this together, and we have a perfect storm of we're seeing what's happening today because of all of this. The other part of this is, the other part, I just have to, I will say, look, I'm a very realist when it comes to the fact that there is some discontent in this country. And I got to tell you, I'd rather light a candle than curse the darkness. We are in law enforcement are given the ability to do some pretty extraordinary things by code of criminal procedure and by laws. That doesn't come without some responsibility on our part. So if there are people in our communities that have a concern and they have some frustration, then I think it is our responsibility to open that dialogue and try and address with those concerns. It should not get to the point where we're dealing with the reactions. We need to be proactive and recognize that in order to be able to have a vibrant community, everyone feels like they're part of that community. So there's another side to this too. I understand where the frustration comes from. And I think as in law enforcement agencies and in our organization, we need to recognize that, and we need to be a part of that solution, trying to find some solutions and to try and build some stronger communities and some stronger relationships. We all own that responsibility to do just that.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, first of all, you're a law enforcement professional. You've been there. You've done that. You've been in the streets. You've had street assignments for
35 years. Yeah, 35 years.
And so you know from whence you speak, but now you're in a unique position. You are the national secretary of an incredibly persuasive organization that unites law enforcement officers, your ability here can catapult this philosophy of yours and help heal because you're in that position. From what I understand, you're now going to actually run for the president of this organization.
That's correct, and I will tell you that I'm not the only person who has that belief that we need to build these relationships. I mean, it's widespread by many of us in the law enforcement profession. So I don't claim ownership for it. I think it's a movement. I just think it's a movement where we all need to promote amongst ourselves, to open those dialogues and have some meaningful discussion with people within our communities. Look, we serve the people in our communities, even the ones who think that we're not effective in providing services to them. I think what we need to do is open that dialogue. I think when we have a better understanding of both of us, both of our views, then we are going to find some solutions that everyone can live with, and at the same time, unite and empower everyone to have one solid vision of where we want to go.
One of the things I wanted to bring up with you is, a couple of the national issues that are affecting law enforcement all over this country. And one is, we are seeing such a diminishment of recruiting and retention that I, in my estimation, we are going to see a crisis in the coming years with staffing law enforcement officers in agencies large and small all over this country. How are we going to combat this?
Well, I think we've already seen it. I don't think the crisis is coming. I think the crisis is here. I'll put it in perspective. Law enforcement officers, you know, they go through some pretty tough times. We deal with a segment of society people would like to, most would like to think don't exist, and don't think that doesn't take a toll on us as individuals. So we also deal with our own internal things where, you know, it's just a very difficult job. You add all of these factors that we're dealing with, and a lack of support services within our profession that don't recognize the stressors on our job. I think you put all of that together, and then you get the negative images that are associated with law enforcement by the media, by Hollywood, by public officials. And I think what you have is an environment where people say, let me see if I got this right. I can go into law enforcement. I can make less money than I can in the private sector. I can live 10 years on average less than an average person who retires. And for all of this, I have a potential that overnight I'm one call away from my life being turned upside down. Yeah, until we get a handle on all of these things, until society recognizes just how important our role is in law enforcement to the quality of our life in our communities, until we start gaining that respect back, and we stop that narrative of attacking us for what we're doing, until we get to the point where district attorneys stop recognizing that allowing people to break the law is somehow going to make our community safer, which we know it will not, until we get a hold on all of these things, we are going to struggle. We're going to struggle to find the best and the brightest to be in the law enforcement profession.
You hit it right on the head. And you know, I call it the culture of confrontation that we have now developed because of the lack of consequences when these confrontations between combative subjects and law enforcement take place. And you just mentioned something really important and critical, and that is that we have seen activist district attorneys become elected and literally creating laws unto themselves where there are no consequences for a number of crimes. And this is affecting not only the safety of our citizens, but the safety of our police.
Well, you know, and blurring, look, there was a study that actually started back in the late 1960s, early 1970s. It's called the broken window theory. And just in a nutshell, everybody in law enforcement is familiar with it because it was kind of the catalyst on when we got to community policing and a lot of the functions that we deal with today. But the premise of it was this, is that decay encouraged more decay. So if you saw something that looked blighted, broken windows on a building, and if you didn't correct that, what you would find was more broken windows and more decay on that property and neighboring property. Take that same belief and carry it into where we are today. And I would argue what we have today is a modern day broken window problem, in that district attorneys, rather than recognizing that we have laws and we need to enforce the laws, are now deciding that some laws are okay to break. And when we blur those lines, it's harder for people to follow. And when it's harder to follow, and you start saying we're not going to prosecute people who have crimes, who do thefts under $750, well, I'm going to ask you what happens to the store owner who's struggling every day to pay his bills when he can't even call the police because somebody came in and shoplifted and took all of his goods under $750. How often can he survive? Where is his rights? So, there's no question we're at a point now where we are kind of losing common sense in approaching our law enforcement role. And if you think that lowering and legalizing certain crimes is going to make a safer community, well, you clearly think you're not going to be one of the victims of those lower crimes that you've decided to basically eliminate. And we're seeing it all across this country. Again, I go back to where I started this whole conversation. If you truly want to fix these things, if you truly want to fix all that we have discussed, let's start having some meaningful discussions about poverty and failing school systems and broken family units and all of these things that are major factors in someone feeling their self-worth. Because if you don't have a feeling of self-worth, you don't see the future. When you don't see the future and you don't have respect for yourself, you certainly don't have respect for others. So there's a much bigger picture here than law enforcement. Well, we are the ones who have to go out and clean up all of these problems because we're the ones that the public has the most contact with. And because of that, we take the brunt of it. But the reality is none of us have anything to do with these other factors. Exactly. We need to stop the failed policies and the failed programs and recognize that there's some accountability for things we do in life. And we need to promote and adopt programs that actually address these issues, not because they feel good, but because they make a difference at the end of the day.
Well said. You know, one thing that I also wanted to bring up, I understand that you are also an author. You wrote a book, Chest Deep and Rising, The Hurricane Katrina Nightmare. That must have been quite an experience for you.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's quite some time ago, but Hurricane Katrina, I think, changed the way we, at least in law enforcement, are in responding to disasters. It has changed the way we respond to them. I think that in our profession, we do very good at planning. We do a lot of tabletop planning. We figure out worst case scenario, and we put together plans in place that help us address what those worst case scenarios are. So if A happens, we do B, and so forth and so on. But when Hurricane Katrina came along, I think there were a lot of misconceptions of what that storm was and the impact that it had. But we had a set of rules, or we had a game book, you know, a game plan. We had all of these plays that we would do if certain things happened, and Katrina went off the chart. And I think it caused us all across this country to recognize that a major city the size of New Orleans could find themselves in such a disarray because of a total breakdown of infrastructure. When you have 80% of a city that goes underwater, and you don't have the ability to move around, you have no ability to be able to communicate because by our infrastructure, you're not supposed to have a single point of failure when it comes to communication systems, yet we found one. All of these things fell apart and created a havoc that created a nightmare. And any one of those incidents that we dealt with during that particular time would have taken days of planning before we executed and had our action plans in place. And, you know, in this case, we were doing them every 5 minutes. And so, yes, I didn't start out to write a book. I had a friend of mine after Katrina. It's probably about 6 month period where it took before things kind of neutralized and kind of take our breaths. But I had a friend of mine sent me something that he written about his time, and he kind of blew me away by reading it. And I decided I was going to do something similar to that, and was going to write something so I could give to my grandkids so they could see some role that I played in this, or that our community and our society played in, you know, such a major disaster. And it kind of evolved into a book, but in reality, what it really did is it evolved into therapy. It allowed me to relive the storm and relive the emotions that we didn't have the opportunity to deal with at the time. And again, even then I didn't want to publish it. I ended up publishing the book to donating the funds to a police foundation that were there helping our members. I had 6,000 members in the state of Louisiana, about one third, 2,000 of them were homeless on August 29th, 2005, trying to give back.
Well, you've had, like I said, a storied career. You've given so much to the law enforcement community, both as in your position with the St. Charles Parish Sheriff's Office, but also, I think, even more importantly, to the law enforcement community as a high-ranking officer in the National Fraternal Order of Police. And I just want to say, you know, we're coming to a close here. We don't have much more time. But I want to wish you luck in the election coming up for president of the FOP. It's clear from my conversations with you that you have a tremendous grasp of the issues facing the American law enforcement officer, and I think you'd be fantastic in that position.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it. We have no shortage of leadership in our organization. The individual running that is also seeking the office, we would be served with having either one. Of course, I have my preference, and I appreciate your well wishes. And our conference will start next week in New Orleans, and we're inviting about 6,000 of our friends over for a week, and we're going to talk about some issues that are important to law enforcement and set our path for the next 2 years. Should be a great conference, but it also gives us an opportunity in New Orleans. The FOP really stood up for us after that storm in 2005, helped us put our lives back together, and this was our way of inviting everyone back and saying thank you for helping us during our darkest hour.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I really do appreciate you taking the time to be on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. Pat Yoes from St. Charles Parish, Louisiana. Once again, thanks for taking the time.
End of Watch with Randy Sutton.
Each week here on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we pay our respects to the men and women of the profession who have given the ultimate sacrifice, their own lives, for their communities. We call it End of Watch. Unfortunately, this week I have two names to read. The first is New York City Police Department Sergeant Thomas J. Fennessy, who died of 9/11-related cancer on July 26th. Sergeant Fennessy died in the line of duty when he succumbed to the cancer that developed following his service at the World Trade Center after the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. He joined the NYPD in 1982, following in the footsteps of his father, James Joseph Fennessy, and several other members who were police officers in the city. Sergeant Thomas J. Fennessy, New York City Police Department, End of Watch, July 26, 2019. The second is Correctional Officer Pedro J. Rodriguez Mateo of the Puerto Rico Police Department, Corrections and Rehabilitation in Puerto Rico. Correctional Officer Pedro Rodriguez Mateo succumbed to injuries sustained the previous day when he was attacked by an inmate at the Ponce Maximum Security Facility. Officer Rodriguez Mateo was supervising inmate visitation when he observed a visitor pass an item to an inmate. He had the inmate removed from the visitation area so he could be searched, but during the search, the inmate attacked the officer and disarmed him of his baton. The inmate, who was serving a 71-year sentence for triple murder, struck Officer Rodriguez Mateo several times, causing him to suffer a skull fracture. He died after he was transported to a local hospital. Officer Rodriguez Mateo is survived by his wife and child. Correctional Officer Pedro J. Rodriguez Mateo, Puerto Rico Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, End of Watch, Thursday, August 1st, 2019. May they rest in peace. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I would urge for you to check me out on Facebook under the voice of American law enforcement. I do want to hear from you. If you have suggestions for the show, please contact me there and let me know. If you are a Twitterer, you can contact me at LT Randy Sutton. That's my Twitter account. And that's it for social media for me. Of course, that isn't true. I shouldn't say that. I guess I'm also on LinkedIn. And if you want to communicate over there, that works too. So thanks again. Make sure you check out thewoundedblue.org. And feel free to contact me if you have any suggestions or comments at my page, The Voice of American Law Enforcement, on Facebook.